These are my obligatory disclosures. I will also disclose that this is my first APHA meeting, and remarkably, up until about 15 seconds ago, I've never been at a meeting where people didn't keep walking out. So I'm not sure. It may be that you're sleeping, maybe you don't have anything else to do, but it's good that you're here. So I want to say at the outset that any molecule that can be detected in blood or urine can also be detected someplace in the oral cavity. This is an important concept. It may not exactly match the blood values, but it'll be there. And later, if there's time, I'll explain why it's there. And this is just a list of the kinds of things that have been detected in oral samples. Because we're talking oral systemic, this is a partial list of conditions in the oral cavity that affect systemic conditions, and on the other side, systemic conditions that have an effect on the oral cavity. This is not surprising. This is the start of the GI tract. I mean, you can't isolate the mouth from the rest of the body. So anything that's going on in the body is going to be reflected someplace in the oral cavity. This is from PubMed, just showing that the use of using saliva as a diagnostic has been increasing rapidly. And this is largely because of advances in science, but it's also, most importantly, due to advances in funding. Because the National Institute of Dental and Craniofacial Research in 2002 made this a big issue and decided to put a lot of money in, and that attracted a lot of investigators that weren't in the field. When we talk about oral testing, typically we think of saliva, but I just wanted to point out that there are various other types of samples that you can get out of the oral cavity with a swab and even with a small mass spec that you can put in the oral cavity that's about this big and will detect volatiles. And people are doing diagnosis of both diabetes and a number of cancers using volatiles that can be detected in the oral cavity. Crevicular fluid is an interesting fluid. It's very difficult to collect, but it's been important in the development of techniques because it's that small amount of fluid, a few microliters, that's between the gum and the tooth. And it much more closely resembles serum than does saliva. Oops, that came in twice. So what I'm going to talk about is my own interest in HIV, TB, and malaria. And as many of you will know, these three diseases, if you do a map of the world and ask, where's their HIV, where's their TB, where's their malaria, they're right on top of each other. They're in the exact same places. And in fact, no one really talks about this, people actually don't die from HIV. HIV suppresses your immune system, and then you're liable to a whole series of other infections. And in the developing world, this is largely TB and malaria, both which are diseases that are much cheaper to treat than HIV. So if we could identify, and so I had the idea about 12 years ago to create a test that would simultaneously detect HIV, TB, and malaria. I was dissuaded from doing this, first by the engineers that I work with, who say it's too big of a problem, you have to deconstruct it, and then some focus groups that we did with various individuals said they're just as happy to have three tests as have one, and that actually turned out to probably be a good idea. So I'm going to briefly talk about each of these, and the first is HIV diagnostics. So the current point of care tests are really screening tests. This is the Oraquick test.
Ready?
Oh no! That's my demonstration one. Don't do it.
I'm not. I was going to do that.
Okay. So you swab your mouth, You put it into a developing tube, and 20 minutes later, you see one line, which is called the control line, and if you see a second line that's called the test line, then it doesn't mean you have HIV. It means you're reactive. There's antibodies or something else that's lighting up that test line. That's called a screening test. If you do that, and this is the one that can be done in a dentist's office, and it is being done in dentist's office and community health clinics, first responders, you then have to do a confirmatory test. And that usually requires the individual to come back or go someplace else. So this may take days or weeks, and in many cases they won't come back. So we wanted to create a combined test, a screening test and a confirmatory test. And that means that it would look at antibodies and the nucleic acid, the viral nucleic acid, which is an RNA. So this is the test that that we developed over the past 10 years. It uses a collector that looks like this. And you can put a drop of blood on it, or you can swab and do a, quote, salivary sample. We typically always start first with a blood test, just because the levels are usually higher and it's quite easy to do. And then we modify the test and make it into a salivary test. So this is the swab. It goes into a plunger that pushes this into a disposable chip. And that chip is shown here. And what I'm going to show you is a movie of colored fluids flowing through here. So the disposable chip sits on a box that is driven by pneumatics. So there's like an air pump in there. The bottom of the chip has valves. It's computer driven, and it takes it to the right place at the right time. And this is the, if it works. So that's adding the sample. The first thing that's going to happen is it's going to get cleaned up a bit, and we're going to do an antibody test. This only takes about 7 minutes, and that's flowing out. And that would be just like the other test that I showed you. The rest of the sample gets purified through a series of steps. It's moving from chamber to chamber. And then it goes into a PCR chamber. The PCR does a series of heating and coolings, which you're going to see in a minute. This is the PCR chamber. And this is the temperature. And then whatever's been amplified runs out on the second strip. And that's the amplified HIV RNA. Okay, so this was sped up, obviously. The current test takes about an hour and 45 minutes. And that's because the PCR, I think everyone's familiar with PCR if you watch any of the crime shows. So you have to heat and cool and heat and cool, usually 20 cycles. We have another assay that uses isothermal amplification. It's called LAMP. Don't ask why. And that takes only about 15 minutes. So we are working with a company that was on my disclosure slide. We are working with a company called Rionics, which is in Ithaca, New York. It's an offshoot of Cornell. I've been working with them for about 5 years. And what we're proposing now is to take this, which is a laboratory assay. What I mean by that, it's open architecture, because when you're developing one of these tests, you're pipetting things in and you're fine-tuning. What we have to do now, really, is only three things. We've got to load the reagents in beforehand, and we're working on that. We've got to close the chip, and then we've got to go to endemic areas and validate that it actually works. So we have an SBIR grant that we put in with the company that's going to be reviewed on December 3rd, and hopefully that would give us enough money to take this from a laboratory test into a commercial test. Moving right along to TB. So the current testing for TB is very low sensitivity, and you need to collect sputum. I didn't realize how hard this was, but it depending on the individual, this can be very difficult to get actually a sputum sample. You don't just spit. You really have to cough up something. It would be very good to, and then once you get the sputum, it's a staining test. And I actually tried to do these, and it's very laborious. You have to sit in front of a microscope and look, and then in fact you have to take that sample and culture it, and it takes weeks. So colleagues of mine at NYU had come up with something very, very interesting. Dr. Susie Zola-Posner, who's at the medical school, had been collecting blood samples from HIV patients since the beginning of the epidemic. She has a freezer with about 20,000 samples. Some of those people had TB when she took the sample, and some of them developed TB later on. And so she actually had a longitudinal study. And so what she and her colleagues did was to go through that and look for molecules that were expressed early on in TB infection. And they actually identified, this is Susie and Suman Lal at the medical school, they identified about 7 proteins that are present in TB that are not expressed when it's latent, but when it activates, they come to the cell surface, and then you make antibodies. And so what's shown here is a series of different proteins, and these are people who are, so the test that we do here is PPD, and any of you that work in a healthcare facility probably know you get one of these once a year. 15% of the people turn up positive, don't have TB. They were either vaccinated as children, depending on where they came from, they lived in an endemic area, or they have been infected, but they controlled the infection. And so they're called PPD positive. PPD negative people are people that are negative for it. And if you test them with this variety of antigens, what you'll see is the PPD negatives and positives are below this cutoff line, whereas the PPD the TB positives are above it. Now, if you do the math on this and take any one of these, they're only about 75 to 82% accurate. However, if you combine 4 of them, you get up to 95%. So they came to us, my group, because we had some experience, and we created a company, 5 of us, and received an SBIR grant and now some funding to try and make this into a serious test. And this slide is using another one of the antigens. And what you see here is that it works almost as well in TB HIV negatives, HIV positives. This is always going to be an issue because many of the tests are compromised by the presence of HIV. Undaunted, we kept going on. And so malaria is the third major killer of HIV-infected individuals. And the current tests use blood smears, and this takes a trained person almost 45 minutes per smear. So you look through a blood smear and you're looking for red blood cells. There's only a few of them that are going to be affected with the Plasmodium falciparum or Vivex. So it's very time consuming. There are some commercial point of care tests for the antigens, but they're insensitive, and also the protein, you could clear the disease either by drugs or by your own immune system, but the protein still exists. So we decided to develop a nucleic acid test, a point-of-care nucleic acid test, and what we would like to do is a test-and-treat program, which is what's being done for HIV in Washington, D.C. and in the Bronx. And that is, you test everybody in a community, and anybody who's positive, you treat. And what this does is this decreases the burden of the disease. In the case of HIV, it decreases the person-to-person transmission. In the case of malaria, this is smarter people than I have modeled this, it makes it more difficult for the mosquito to identify a positive. So you can do the math on that. If there's everybody is infected in a village, then any Anopheles mosquito that bites anybody will pick up the parasite. If you decrease the number of infected people, that mosquito can't find who's infected and who's not. They're smart, but they're not that smart. So on this test, we first again started with PCR. We have a couple publications on this, but it was too slow, because if this is going to be used in a mobile laboratory and like a truck going out, you need something very simple where you can go to a remote area and test people right there, give them an answer in less than, we think, 20 minutes. And so this is the test that was created by the engineers that I work with at the University of Pennsylvania. This is the device. And very clever. So for isothermal, you have to go up to 65 degrees and then hold that temperature for the length of time that you're going to do the assay. So what we thought about was the hand warmers. You know, the hand warmers where you crush something and it heats up and they keep your hands warm for about an hour. So we deconstructed the hand warmers, and it's a series of magnesium salts that when they react with water, they give off what's called an exothermic reaction. If you take the right amount of magnesium salts and add water, you can get it to go to 65 degrees and it'll hold it for an hour. So what happens in this device, this is the whole device that I just held up. There's a chamber here where you add water. There's a paper wick that takes it up to the chambers where the reagents and the samples are present. And then 20 minutes later, you take a Radio Shack light that costs $5 that has the right wavelength, and you shine it on the chip. And so this is a chip that has three chambers. This one is positive, these two are negative. And you can take this chip and lay it on a cell phone and send the results to somebody else that is looking for it. So we're very excited about this. This still is what I call a laboratory test, because we pipette in the reagents of the sample. And we are working with the development office at NYU to identify a foundation that would be willing to fund this. And like I said with the HIV chip, we've done most of the work. We've spent years on this. But the last parts start to get expensive, because they mean going to other places. We don't have any malaria in the U.S. Although, interestingly, in Central Park, we have the right mosquito. And so there is a risk if an immigrant came from an endemic area and had malaria and happened to visit Central Park, we could wind up with malaria in New York City. I use that as a selling point when we try and raise money. So I wanted to do one more sales pitch, because what we're talking about is oral systemic and interprofessional model. And if you'll notice at the bottom, we are, since 2005, the NYU College of Nursing and Dentistry. It's the first case that we know of still, where two schools that seem to have totally different agendas, languages, personalities, genders, merged. And it wasn't smooth, but over the years it's gotten better and better. And in 2015, they'll actually move to, nursing will move to the same site as dentistry, which is going to go even better. So we have initiated a whole host of interprofessional studies. And just to show you, this is we have a nursing faculty practice that's present in the dental school, and it's staffed by nurse practitioners, and dental students rotate through there. The nurses, they're both on the same floor, and nurses from the nurse practitioner go into the dental clinic and teach the dental students about taking blood pressures and talking about diabetes, and nurses go into the nursing students go into the dental practices to learn about that, and dental students, it's still small. We only can handle about 15 students at a time. But this is going to be a growing program, and I think will have a large impact on oral systemic and certainly interprofessional. So that's my sales pitch. And for those of you that weren't listening, oh, by the way, not only did nobody leave, but I've only seen about 4 people with their devices out. I'm very impressed.
What meetings do you have?
So I'm not going to read all this, but this is a summary of what I've said. And as you can imagine, it really takes a village to do this. So I was at the University of Pennsylvania for 22 years, and I've continued my collaborations with the University of Pennsylvania, recruited people at NYU in dentistry and medicine, and unfortunately I left nursing off, but we also have a number of collaborations with nursing and places around the world, and I'm not embarrassed to say that we need corporate connections, because the NIH will not fund the next level. So we actually do have to go to foundations and corporates. And with that, I caught us up on time.
So. Thank you. Don't forget all your gadgets. Okay.